This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 6, Episode 9 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today, we're beginning a new series in which we're going to look at Star Trek The Next Generation writer, producer, showrunner Maurice Hurley and his work as a movie writer. But today, we're going to look at what he did on Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And we're joined by Larry Nemechek. How's it going, Larry?
Hey, guys. It's great. I personally just survived a convention back home in Oklahoma at SoonerCon, and I've been talking all day, and I think I got a little more talk left in me.
Excellent. I don't think that you ever lose your ability to talk, I'm guessing. Just from my experiences with you, I think you have plenty of talk left in the tank, right?
It's there to come out if the lips in the you know, forming cavity will cooperate. That's the only question.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. You know, we love having you on the show. I've said in the past that you're our cue, and
but my robes aren't near as red as his are. So, no, that's thank you guys. That's very kind. That's very nice.
But yeah, you know, I mean, we like having you on the show. For some reason, lately, we've only been having you on when people die, unfortunately. We need to change that.
Yes, we do.
But,
oh, right.
Yes, the reason why we're covering Maurice Hurley today is because he did pass away recently. And he was, you know, a Star Trek showrunner. There aren't that many people who can say that. And he was a significant voice. He really did help to shape the series Next Gen, and we thought it was only right to take a closer look at him because he's the guy who really seems to get overlooked on Next Generation, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. When I did the companion book, you know, I came in the fifth season, and there was so much early. We kind of obliquely, politely say there was a merry-go-round the first couple of years, but there was a lot of gnashing and, you know, whatevering, and bit by bit as the years go by and people either feel like talking about it or whatever, and, you know, things you knew at the time and were not PC enough to be able to. I mean, I tried to be honest and at least say there was a conflict or creative difference or something between blah and blah, you know, X and Y, and at least address it, even if it can only just barely do it in a bare-bones way at the time, either because that's all I could say or because people wouldn't talk at the time. But since then, you know, we've had the bits of, you know, Leonard Majlis, Gene's attorney, interfering in the first season, and then by the end of the first season, him kind of finally being put out to pasture, and then all the different producers and writers, and Dorothy Fontana and David Gerald, you know, not being happy and leaving, and they were the old guard Gene started with, and then all this troop of writers that kind of circle around, and then finally, but yeah, by the end of the first season, Maury Hurley had kind of survived the demolition derby, and wound up being the quote-unquote showrunner, although I still think it was kind of a weak, you know, the show was not weak, but I mean the show was still a little wobbly, and it wasn't quite as the way we think of the showrunner being Michael or Jerry or, you know, Brannon later on, and all the different, or Ira on DS9. It wasn't quite as gelled a thing, because Gene was still alive, and Gene was alive, and he was increasingly not as healthy and involved, but he would still weigh in. You know, in third season, they were still arguing over mentioning whether Sarek's son that Picard saw the wedding of was Spock or not, you know, and that was Gene driving that, and Gene driving Ira and some of the third season writers crazy. So he would, first and second season, Gene was still a factor, but Maury Hurley eventually rose to the pack of the rest of the writers, the head writer, I guess. So yeah, and he deserves to be in, and he made some major contributions, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, for those people who don't know, he was, you know, we'll say, for lack of a better term, the showrunner for the first two seasons of Next Generation before leaving. He wrote a total of, 10 episodes during those two seasons, including things like Data Lore, The Neutral Zone, Q Who was his big one, I think, and Shades of Grey. And then he left the series and came back to do two episodes later on, one in season 4, which was Galaxy's Child, and one in season 5, which was Power Play. And then he came back one more time to write a treatment for a potential Star Trek VII screenplay, which ended up not being used. So, okay, let's take it back and you know, look at his work as a showrunner. Okay, so you're saying that there was turmoil and whatnot, and he eventually rose to the pack. Now, when did that happen? Because I'm assuming that that Roddenberry, like you were saying, you know, he stuck around for a while and obviously was giving input, but seeing as how he created the show, I'm guessing that at the beginning he was very involved in it before stepping back a little bit. Is that accurate?
Well, right. But, you know, Gene, I mean, even the original series, when he was, you know, younger and more into the flow of things, and they had a much smaller staff and smaller budgets, and TV wasn't quite as, you know, I don't know, maybe it was a better way to work, or maybe it was just, now it's just being bloated, and they were just tougher guys back then. But, you know, when Bob Justman talks about the first season, and the show would get behind, and Gene was having to crank out everything, and there was maybe, you know, like John D.F. Black was the original second writer, and then, you know, they found Gene Kuhn, and Gene Kuhn was like the machine who could crank stuff out and keep them on track. But there were times when Gene Roddenberry would do the rewrites, and Bob, like, they would shut down production, and Bob would talks about going in and standing on his desk while he typed, you know, and then they would hand him the pages, and then he would climb down and go out, and they'd have him sent to Mimeo back then, you know, kind of a thing. So the idea of, in the 20 years, the way the TV industry worked is was to have bigger, you know, writers and writer rooms. It was a good thing, and it wasn't on Gene's shoulders by any means, but he was like Mr. Vito, and he had a few credited scripts, but it was mainly the story developments and then Mr. Vito, and he would weigh in with his comments kind of in an executive way. And if something was close to his heart, then he would weigh in a big way. But yeah, a lot of it was his attorney, Mazelish, getting involved in ways he shouldn't have, and finally the Writers Guild investigated and kind of shut it down. It's like, I'm sorry, do you have a writer on your staff Leonard Mazelish? Well, if he is, he needs to get guild certification, because we don't have any record of Leonard Mazelish in the Writers Guild. so that finally went away, and after all that turmoil happened, of all the writers who were left, Maury Hurley did kind of rise to the top of the pack. But what I was going to also mention, you're reading off all the things he's credited on. Just remember that as a show, one of the definitions of a showrunner is they do polish rewrites. Even when somebody else does it, even when there's maybe an uncredited rewrite on somebody's script, like a staffer doing a freelancer script or whatever, a showrunner may take one more pass on it themselves and usually not take credit on it. But so his hand was, his ideas and notes and even rewrite hand were on almost all the scripts, probably from midway through first season onward through his, you know, at the season and a half at least. You always have to remember that whoever, like Michael or Jerry or Ira, they're looking at stuff even if their name's not on the script. The formal credits, yeah.
So let's go back to Gene's lawyer there for a second, because I guess I wasn't really too familiar with that whole thing, but like, was it just that he was like a really big Star Trek fan who was like, here's my chance? Or, I mean, like, what exactly was he doing in the first place? Why was he like, yeah, I'm going to start, you know, giving script notes and whatnot, or whatever it was that he was doing?
Well, that's kind of what boggled. Well, some of this is just now starting to come out or be able to be talked about. He passed away a few years ago, but David Gerald has been more open about talking about this. And, you know, like, listen to the interview he did with John and Ken on Mission Log. We did this, he and I have part of this in an interview with him we did while we were at FedCon last year, and I haven't done anything with it, but just talking about, it's kind of like in a twisted way of protecting Gene or protecting the show, but just got way more involved than he should have, and yeah, it was like giving notes and telling writers what to do, and it's like, well, I'm the voice of Gene, so listen to what I'm doing, and you know, Gene's wants me to do this, and anyway, just it was very confusing, and they had a really disruptive process. That they didn't have quite the clean cut writer's room, you know, break sessions and all that. They would do a lot of not so much formal meeting everybody face to face, but do a lot of just memos around, and it just wasn't quite as tight a system as later on. And so, but that was finally, he was kind of finally put back in his box by midway through the first season, basically. And that's kind of when things kind of settled down. And if you notice things, they also brought in a couple more. That was when Hannah Louise Shearer and Tracy Torme came into the staff. Tracy Torme had pitched the idea of Dixon Hill, and then he wrote it. And then after that, they brought him on staff. And I just remember watching the show come off week after week and realizing the end of the first season, it finally started to solidify. By the time Conspiracy and by the time of The Neutral Zone, it was like, so exciting. Oh, look, they're having an uplift going into the second season. Okay, it was worth waiting through April 1, and it was worth waiting through Coming of Age, you know, and it's settling down. And part of that, and we weren't, at the time, I wasn't so savvy as to think, oh, look, because Maury Hurley was just one of the producers up there. I was looking at who were the newer names, not whose title was increasing. But that was part of it. There was just a lot less chaos behind the scenes in the writing process. And that was actually starting to show up on screen in little baby steps.
Yeah, I was going to ask that since, I mean, I don't know, John, were you watching Next Gen at this point in time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. From the beginning. And I agree with you, Larry. You felt at the end of the first season like, wow, okay. It's just like any other show that is on the air now where, you know, you're kind of like, okay, this is all right for the majority of the first season. And then you get just this burst of creativity at the end where you're like, okay, they've got it together. They figured it all out. Mm-hmm. And they know how they're going to work together going forward. Like that.
I knew if I just hung in there with them, they wouldn't let me down.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right.
I didn't leave at the third quarter when they were down 14. No, I stayed with it. Yeah.
Great analogy.
So I mean, I can definitely see that, you know, in the second half of season one, it's starting to turn around. I mean, things like, you know, The Big Goodbye, for sure. That's what it's called, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's The Long Goodbye is the Altman thing. Okay. The Big Goodbye, and then, yeah, Conspiracy and Neutral Zone, which, you know, was set up, I guess, as the season finale. And I don't know. I mean, it's been a long time since I've watched that episode, but am I right in thinking that it was definitely intended to be setting up the Borg? Is that correct?
Yeah. By the time the chaos is ended, having a lack of chaos means you can start making long-range plans, you know, and if you're going to be the one in charge, hey, we got through our first season. Let's start to put some stability into this thing and let's have a plan, guys, which is what anybody should do. So yeah, and you know, like the Ferengis did not work out as the big new baddie, and they did decide to go use the Romulans. But if you look at that, it's kind of like, oh, it's almost, when in one way you could say, okay, well, damn, our whole stand alone on your own new stuff and don't reuse original series, you know, dictum. We had to go back on that because the Ferengis didn't work out and were, you know, paper tigers and all that. So now we're going to have to backtrack on our plan and use like the Romulans now. But if you look at that, they actually use the Romulans as an intriguing stepping stone to whatever the new baddie is going to be, right?
Yeah, for sure.
It was somebody, if people were so busy and being thrilled back in the day going, oh my God, it's the Romulans, and look, here's their new ship and here's their new uniforms and this is so cool, and thank God it feels like Star Trek, wasn't it? You know, but it was just an opening door to introduce what was going to become the Borg. Although it was what we do know of this. I should say right off, when I did the first edition of the Companion, it was 5 years in, and because of all that turmoil at the beginning, a lot of people were kind of burned and didn't want to talk from the first couple seasons. Plus, I was having to do the whole damn thing in like 3 months, which stretched out into 6 months. So I was doing lucky to get to talk to the people, to Brannon and Michael and Jerry and Rick, who were there cranking out stuff at the time, much less a lot of the early people who came and left, even if they were in a happy state of mind when they left or whatever. So, and it seems like a long time, but only having it been 2 and 3 and 4 years, there were some people who were still a little raw. So I didn't talk to Maury Hurley then at the time. I remember there was an interview in Starlog done during his run, not after he left. And that was all I really ever saw, and I used a little bit, a few of the bits and pieces from that, you know, annotated. And then the years went by, and then it came up again, like you said, with the generations options. And I had wanted to circle back to him, but since most of the oomph was about, it was deadline, and I had to get on with, you know, the nitty-gritty of generations, there wasn't a whole lot of time in the moment to go over here and explore this. And then you're off and running with all the damn spinoff shows, and they're cranking stuff out. And it wasn't until just a few years ago that I tried to reach out to him again, because, like you said, he, if nothing else, he created the Borg and needs the kudos for that, and everything that became. And we corresponded back and forth a little bit, and this was in maybe 07, 08. And basically he said, you know, oh, well, nobody wants to, he was a little older. And as I guess we know now, it passed away this year. So this is 3, 4, 5 years ago. But he basically said, oh, no one cares. You know, don't go talk to the younger guys. I said, okay, but I just want to make sure I think you deserve, you know, credit for not only running the show, but, you know, creating the Borg is something that will be forever, and you deserve your fair share of credit of that. And I wanted to let you, you know, speak to that. And he was said something like, oh, I'm getting too old for this kind of shit. So it was kind of the mood he was in where he was. And I just, that's one of the things that there's a lot of people that got away that I never even got to approach, or that things happen so fast. But he's one that I actually did approach and couldn't talk into it. So although I'm trying to think, I think I heard where Shatner got him on this famous Canadian documentary that hasn't really been seen in the States yet about the turmoil of the first couple of years. Some of what we're talking about will be in. So I knew that Rob Burnett and Roger Lay approached him when they were doing the Blu-ray remastered TNG documentaries, you know, that so many people, that I've spoken and a ton of people, and Ira told the turmoil of the third season underneath Michael with the old and the new guard. And that all kind of got exposed and out to air for the light of day. But they couldn't get Maury to come in even on that. And somehow Shatner must have thrown some money at him or something, but convinced him to come talk, and I'm still waiting to see. You know the documentary I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's called, like, what is it, like Panic on the Bridge or
something
Chaos
like that.
On the Bridge or something
to see
like
that. Because that will answer millions of unknown questions about 20th century first and second season Next Generation. Some of this very topic we're talking about now. So, but until then, we know what we know, and he deserves all the credit for the Borg and trying to ride herd on a crazy, crazy ship there that was still, you know, even beyond him and the writers, was still settling into a groove, you know, all around.
But wasn't he, I mean, speaking of the turmoil, weren't there a number of people that cited him as the reason they left? Like, they just didn't like working with him?
That could be. I know somewhere part of it was over Maislish's interference. And then that went away. And then some of the writers they had were established writers who were, you know, in their 40s and 50s. And I mean, I would like to make sure of sources and that, but that doesn't surprise me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just some stuff here on Memory Alpha, mm-hmm. on the audio commentary for the pilot of Sliders. Tracy Torme said that he named a character after Hurley because it was, I guess it was a sort of a bad guy or whatever, and he said that he left after numerous disagreements over Torme's scripts. He said that mm-hmm. Herbert J. Wright described him as basically playing drinking buddies with Gene in some book and stuff. So, I mean, there definitely seemed
playing
to be a
politics,
lot of...
Yeah, office politics or whatever.
And I guess the other thing about that, you know, which, of course, is very famous at this point, is after season one, he's the guy who wanted to get rid of Gates McFadden.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Which no one at the time really wanted to get into, but that's, yeah, basically true.
Yeah, yeah, I know, like, Rick Berman in that that interview thing that he did for the Television Academy or whatever it was, that, mm-hmm. like, 4-hour thing, you know, he talked about it, you know, quite candidly. But yeah, I mean, what and was
then,
the reaction?
And then when Hurley left at the end of the second season, then it was, do we want three doctors in 3 years? Or do we just want to, are we all clear to have Gates come back? And, you know, because you still had Wesley's character there.
Right.
You know, you still had Will Wheaton. So, you know, if you wanted to get back to the whole mother-son dynamic and try to get on with that, and maybe now that you're writing, you know, Wesley better without the, you know, the shut up Wesley era, which was never Will's fault. I always felt bad for him when those idiot fans in the 80s were booing him. And so, like, no, go boo the writers. Or go boo Leonard Mazelish or whatever. But, you know, don't boo the kid. My God. And then scars him for life or whatever, you know, only to come back and, you know, conquer the internet. But
We were talking about that just recently. And, you know, we were talking about where no one has gone before. And, you know, after watching that again a couple of times in the past, like, year or so, like, to me, it seems like they really had set up all the stuff that they did with Wesley in that episode. You know, that episode seems to be like the key for that character. And, you know,
well, that
it's
was
like,
the arc, right? They were gonna, you read the writer's guide, and they were, you know, in the very early episode, we find out that, you know, he's a Mozart like prodigy and has these special abilities, and that becomes, you know, but how do you do that in a human way? And that was, yeah, that was part of it. That was baked into the character to begin with.
Yeah. It's, I think people miss that too often, but no, whatever.
With Maury.
So what was the reaction? I mean, from both of you as you were watching, because I didn't come into Star Trek until midway through season 6 of this show. What was the reaction when all of a sudden season 2 starts up and there's a new doctor? For whatever reason.
Honestly, my first reaction the first time I ever saw Dr. Pulaski was confusion, because I really liked Dr. Crusher. And when I saw her on, I was like, so is she just on for like an episode or something? And I was a kid, and I rolled with it. I never had like a huge problem with her, but I didn't like her as much as Dr. Crusher, you know, like I was just like, meh. And, you know, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it at the time. When I go back and watch the second season episodes now, yeah, it really, the lack of, chemistry, I guess, shows through, but, you know, in the moment I wasn't hypercritical of it.
What about you, Larry?
Well, this is, you know, before The Companion, and I'm just a fan in Oklahoma watching. I like to think a very dialed-in fan. And I subscribed to Interstat, which was an LOC, which is a letter of comment zine for new newbies. So back in the pre-internet era, you would get a little, Terry Meyer for nearly 20 years did this letter zine where it was people writing about topics. It wasn't zine like fan fiction. It was a zine that was people wrote letter. Like it came out once a month, you know, and she typed it on stencils and all that. But and it was, you know, offset printed. But it was people writing letters back and forth, exchanging ideas, and they would write topics and things. But there were also some news columns in it. And so pre-internet, and even with like Entertainment Tonight, you know, putting stuff out beyond people's deaths and things, it was still a happy dappy filter, you know. But just to hear what, and to have somebody going through the trade, going through Variety and Hollywood Reporter, you know, when deals were signed or people were cast and all that, it was kind of like you got, it was your filter to the world. But in all of 1 month, and you would like write a letter in, and then next month somebody would reply to that, and then you would reply back to them, or you would reply back to 8 different people, and they're talking. But I seem to remember between that and maybe Starlog, you know, back when it was in the beginning, it was way more relevant and not so PR puffery toward the end.
Yeah.
But I do remember knowing that, because then on ET watching, because you would like, I'd pay attention to any Star Trek news. Since Entertainment Tonight was Paramount, they always had first dibs on stuff. And the video library they pulled from that Don Beck had for years when they would do TV specials and things. The ET, the Entertainment Tonight library of interviewing and events and all that was kind of in the Star Trek promotional library to use too. They were just kind of one and the same. And I remember, like, they did a little story on the Star Trek rap, season one rap party, you know, they showed up, and I remember them talking to Gates, and somehow I had this memory of having read that they were going to change doctors, and not, you know, not saying, oh, Maury Hurley ran her off, but but saying that they were, that Gates was not going to come back for, you know, whatever the politic, nice, tactful language was, Gates was not coming back. But knowing that that was not widely known by the public or most of fandom, because they talked to her and didn't say a thing about it in the story, in the video story on Entertainment Tonight. I just remember watching it going, okay, well, she's just going to smile, and they're going to smile when they ask her questions. And, oh, it's been a very fun year, first year and a gala year. And, you know, this has been some kind of glib, you know, generic answer. And I was like, wow, they're not going to talk about her leaving the show. I mean, I was aware of it at that time, but that was just for me being very clued in on the couple of channels we had then to be part of. And then they wait, I guess it was kind of like, as a diplomatic thing, it's kind of like, let's end the first season and not blow this up with a, you know, big story. And plus they had just gone through the, you know, the Denise Crosby is leaving the show stuff, you know, and that was of her own accord. And they had just gone through that, and there's some kind of a PR angle here. No, the show is not falling apart. No, half the cast is not leaving, being fired, you know, kind of a stability thing they wanted to project. But I remember watching a little show on ET about the rap party and interviewing Gates and thinking, wow, they didn't mention a thing about her leaving. And I want to say they'd already talked about Pulaski, and they'd already talked about, or if not the character name, they'd talked about Diana Muldaur. And at the time thinking, well, okay, she was on the original series, so she's got, you know, Star Trek in her DNA, and I remember, knew she liked Gene, or Gene and her got along well, so that makes sense. And boy, it'll sure be a you know, it's not cookie cutter; it's a sure contrast. And it's like, oh well, that's the way the world is. But thinking, gee, that's too bad. They're losing, you know, the Wesley and Beverly dynamic as mother son and all that. So, but that's where my mind was.
Okay, and now season two in general. I know. I mean, the first two seasons, I guess, are really considered, you know, at least looking at them in hindsight, to be problematic. But I'm
and two less so than one.
Okay, two less so than one. I guess that was going to be my first question, because you had the writer's strike going on at that point in time, and obviously they were trying to sort of like piece together stuff. And I mean, I don't know exactly how. I mean, maybe you can tell us, like, was it that it was impending and they were like, we need to get this done fast before they start striking? Or was it where they actually had to stop working like mid-season? But whatever it was, it seems like Hurley, you know, had the deck stacked against him going into season two.
Well, in a way, but the strike was actually in spring and summer. So the strike actually affected the end of season one.
Okay, so it was more like once they came back, they were like, "Oh shit, we need to go really fast."
I mean, they had the main scripts written, but like in the later, like, what am I trying to think of? The one with "They'll Always Have Paris." So the Mannheim effect and the Mannheim lab and the time displacement and all that, and data with the multiple data with the pots on sticks and all that stuff.
Yeah,
it was like Rob Legato, bless his heart. One of the one real interview I got to do. The first time around on set with somebody for real live, he was talking about the end of that show because they were on. He was the visual effects guy stuck with trying to make it was kind of like, oh, just make something work there. That whole lab thing was him figuring out a cheap, easy way to do a time displacement effect and just shot Brent like in three ways, you know, holding that stick with the pot with the, you know, with the red matter in it, for lack of a better word. But I mean, he was talking about how they were on strike and he technically couldn't communicate with the writers, but they called the writer and he's like, well, you know, you can't write this scene, but if I was writing this scene, do you have any suggestions? I mean, they literally were talking. So, but the strike was spring and summer. They cut four shows out of the second season, which is why it's, you know, got four shows less. Instead of 22 instead of 26, which is hysterical because now that's a long season now.
Yeah, it's practically three seasons now.
Yeah, well, yeah, depending. Yeah, if you're in the old school model or the HBO BBC model or whatever. But,
yeah.
Yeah, but But yeah, the strike we think about, that was actually in the spring and summer. So it was, it messed up the end of the spring, and then people were paranoid about what to do with the fall, and they were going to, you know, looking back at the pile of, you know, that's when they went back and found this child. What are the old bot scripts already for phase two that we can just, you know, mark out Kirk, write in Picard, and what makes sense the easiest. And that's where you came out with the child, which actually wasn't too bad for that. But it's amazing because this is the season when they added Guinan and built Tin forward, you know, mm-hmm. coming over, which Herman Zimmerman actually designed before he left to work on Star Trek V. And that's when he left and they hired Richard James in full time. But it was actually Herman who finished designing the D interiors with, you know, Tin forward and that. But having, you know, that was all the new, there was so much hoo-ha going on that break. It was the writer's strike, yeah, but it was like letting Gates go, and they were hugely keen in the press to say, gee, it was just about, of course they didn't mention the, you know, stuff with Hurley. It was kind of like, well, we just didn't think the character was, you know, we love Gates, she's a wonderful actress, it's not her performance, just don't like the way it's developing. I mean, at the time, Rick was doing the party line and said, oh, it was Gene, didn't think it was coming along, and I was a big fan of Gates, and, you know, but it was Gene. Of course, Gene was dead by then. And not blaming Gene, but just, you know, in that we had creative differences kind of thing. So, you know, and then Pulaski being, oh, she's a McCoy and Krusty and all that. And this is something that's not well known, but if you actually look in the writer's guide, they gave her three different children by three different men. They were formerly husbands. That's something that never got brought up in dialogue. I think she says somewhere she was a mother or she had a kid or something, but they didn't say she had either three different husbands or at least three kids by three different men. So that was, you know, she was supposed to be kind of, she'd been around the turn or two. So she was kind of Picard's equal as far as, not as a love interest or, you know, like the sexual chemistry that Gates would have had or that Crusher would have had, but, that she could stand toe to toe with it. Which, if you think about the early shows, they tried to bring that out a little bit.
What was the reaction to the Borg when it came out? I mean, was there any sort of lead up where in the press, was there this thing where it's like, hey, there's a big thing coming up, you know, you better watch out for the Borg, they're coming to get you, or did it just sort of drop and everyone was like, oh my God, that's the most amazing thing ever, or did people not care? I mean, what was the climate like leading up to that and then the reaction to it once it happened?
My memory, I'm not as plugged in as you were. I was just a young fan out in the middle of nowhere. And I remember.
Well, I was just a fan who had been around the bend a couple of times, listening as close as I could to what was being given out. So I was still in Oklahoma and still, you know, no big deal at all. So that's why I'm curious to hear what you.
Well, okay. in my relatively clueless bubble. I didn't really pay as close attention back then. I remember seeing the episode for the first time and absolutely loving it. Just thinking, you know, this is fantastic. And I couldn't, you know, I wanted to see them again. I wanted to see the episode again immediately. I was like, that was so cool. I can tell you that was my reaction. That was my brother's reaction. And then when I talked to my friends at school after the episode, that was their reaction too, was, did you see that one? And so we all loved it. We all wanted more Borg.
Well, what about you, Larry?
Well, yeah, I mean, the show that I really remember thinking, okay, Nick TNG has really turned the corner and made it, and it's going to be something major, was next season, Yesterday's Enterprise. I just remember, holy crap, they finally equaled what the power that the movies could bring. And I don't remember feeling that way with Q Who, but it was still very cool and it was still very scary. And the moment when Picard finally says, it was kind of like the oh shit moment, you know, it's almost like the end of Wrath of Khan when, you know, he looks over, David looked over and says, we're not going to make it, are we? Or whoever it was says that. It's kind of that, it's that moment, you know, and then Picard's begging Q, and it gets into that little dynamic. But your audience member going, you know, okay, so you, Q and Picard are having this debate, but who the fuck are these guys?
It's like, yeah.
You know, holy crap. And the fact that Guinan was in the mix. Of course, the other end of that show was the one, the bit was the one where Guinan and Q are like doing like cat's claws at each other. And you're like, we're going to have like, you know, like zap rays come out of their fingers like it's some stupid comic book hero thing. Oh, I didn't say that, did I? Did I say that? Okay. Or just like DS9's show with the paw rays or something. But yeah, but the buildup. Because if you go back and like look at the teasers, it was just, you know, the old guy doing his like, we're a new enemy of the Federation. You know, it wasn't like today they would do that. But back then, it wasn't some big buildup. It was the middle of the season. And like, how excited could you get about a show in the middle of the season? It wasn't a finale or a, you know, or a season premiere. But and they weren't even into the whole thing of the two-parters yet. You know, it started with Best of Both Worlds and or putting stuff in ratings. You know, sweeps months. It was just an all-new threat next week on The Next Generation at the time. You
bring that up. You bring up those promos, and like I remember seeing them back in the day. But by the time that I had seen them, they changed the voiceover to the standard trailer voiceover guy, and not the guy who they had at the beginning of the season. But they're all on the Blu-rays, and like I just watched Q Who yesterday, and I always watch it with the promo to start, you know, and you get to see it, and I'm like, this is so great. But you know who that voiceover guy is? He's Ernie Anderson, who is the father of Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
Anyway, so what were we talking about? Star Trek?
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting. But then, like, once it happened, so there wasn't. You're saying that.
But what John said about the minute you saw the show, you wanted. I mean, because the minute you saw the show, you wanted to go. Okay. Well, that's great. Now, who are those guys in the cube? You know. Let's look at that.
Yeah.
Because it was a whole new concept of the faceless name. And that was, you know, the Borg weren't, you know, we talk about, Hurley should get credit as the creator of the Borg. It wasn't this clean-cut, you know, seven-day creation cycle. I mean, they wanted this relentless, they were looking for a relentless, faceless, not a Romulan, Klingon, Ferengi type, you know, individual character-driven, different actors playing roles with names. Quasi-humanoid. They were wanting this faceless horde approach, and the first thing they came up with, they actually were like something kind of like the little bugs in Conspiracy. They were trying to find something like that, except they thought the little at the time. Now they would do CG and it would be insane, but at the time they had little stop motion rubber guys, and it just looked kind of goofy. You know, when you finally saw the thing run across the room in Conspiracy, the little alien parasite guys.
Yeah.
So, but they were talking about something that was like massive and faceless and not humanoid in psychology at all, which is, you know, where they got up to, although the drones are humanoid. But they were talking about having it be like an insectoid race or something that was just like, you know, just like you know, hives of insects or, you know, colonies of the insects coming at you, and they're not about individuality. And so it was kind of a thing of they didn't know how they were going to portray that on their budget at the time. But that's the roots of all those traits came through to, you know, the Borg and the facelessness and the relentlessness. And we don't care about politics or resources. We just, aside from just surviving and consuming. And we don't, the hive mind and the connected, you know, that got totally, you know, the needs of Best of Both Worlds and then the drama they exploited for, say, Iborg, you know, with Hugh, and then all the stuff with where it went with Voyager and, you know, Matrix Zero by the time they were done with it, all the iterations they could turn that whole hive mind collective consciousness thing inside out. But in the beginning, it was just all about being an unconventional, you know, not another political empire coming at us kind of thing, but that. And even though it went through those iterations, and the other thing was, originally, the whole 7 minutes into the future Picard from the toilet bowl vortex, Time Squared, that was supposed to have been, you know, it played out, but at the end of the show, you were going to find out that whole vortex thing had been caused by these guys who show up in the next show who are the Borg. But they had so many they had so many problems developing the show and the you know, going around and around about what would they look like and be, and it finally winding up with the humanoid drones and being the Borg. And how the hell are we going to afford this in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the season, when we didn't set back money for it? You know, and all that. What can we afford to do? They had to separate the two shows and just have the drama of, you know, have the story of one be self-contained and the story of the other one be self-contained. But that was originally going to be a two-parter, which would have been, you know, a two-parter in season two. But that was originally going to be linked, and the Borg were going to be the answer to why that time displacement happened, and you had the two Picards.
That's interesting. You know, it's curious because to me, like, I never, like, for as long as I've known Next Gen, there's been the Borg. For as long as I've known Star Trek, there's been the Borg. You know, the first time that I saw that and Best of Both Worlds was part of a Viewer's Choice marathon, you know? So I got all of my Borg all in the span of, you know, a few hours. And, you know, it's kind of strange to think about, you know, the fact that over a year had passed before they brought these guys back, you know? Was there, like, a lot of anticipation for them to return? Or...
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say, was the minute... It's almost like, be careful what you wish for, Lieutenant. The minute they did this story, everyone loved the Borg so much. It was like, okay, bring them back. And then it was like, okay, now hell, we just made these relentless, faceless, all victorious, all powerful, going to cream our flagship guys, you know, in a second. How the hell do we bring them back? What do we do? How do we beat them again without having, you know, weakening them? How do we, you know, not lose this, what we've got? And so it took them a year and a half to figure out what to do, you know, how to do that, how to bring them back and do it in a good way without, you know, betraying the idea of them. How do we not destroy their coolness and mysteriousness and you know, invincibility, but still have our guys win?
And by that point in time, Hurley was off the show. So, I mean, I guess we can kind of talk about that. I mean, it sounds like Next Gen kind of took its toll on him, and he was not very keen to come back for season three. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah, in fact, if we're moving along here, like Eric Stillwell, who was who had been a PA and then became the script coordinator. I'm sorry, there in the right, who in the old days would have been the script typist or the head script typist or something, but Eric and then Lolita Faggio was there for several years. He kind of got left with at the end of the year. That's why Shades of Grey exists. We had Shades of Grey because he was so eager to get out the door, not so eager that out the door he helped hire a replacement who wound up being Michael Wagner for a few weeks. But he and Michael Piller had been buddies, and he and Michael had talked to him about it, or he talked to Michael about it. But they had just, by the time they had their lunch, they had just hired Michael Wagner. And he told him that, and he's like, but, you know, why don't you go ahead and write us, you know, do a script for us. And I love how on one end of the real world spectrum, you have all these junior writers, you know, killing themselves to get their spec scripts written or read. You know, they write spec scripts, they try to get people to read them, they try to get feedback and coverage, and they're trying to get looked at and trying to get an agent so they can get a script in a door and get someone to read it. And on the other end, you have all the guys who have been writing for years and know each other. And they go, you know, and they're having lunch. Yeah, I'm running Star Trek now, but I'm going to leave. And, you know, we just hired a new guy to run the show, but why don't you put your hand in, come in and do a story for us. And, you know, it's just that range of, you know, that cavalier, the way one end is scrambling to get into the game and the other end, they're playing the game. But, I mean, that's life. But, yeah, that's what happened. He did get his successor hired and all that long enough. But, on the other hand, he was like out the door and didn't let the screen door, you know, bang him in the butt on the way out the door. And that's why Shades of Grey was not even like a full story. It was kind of like, okay, we'll do a clip show and I can be out of here. We can shoot. Part of it was budget a little bit. They only had to shoot 3 days of real original footage, you know, one day of a crappy log on the Planet Hell set and 2 days of Troy and Pulaski staring at Frakes laying in the bed with the sheet and the thing around his head. And that was, you know, that was the original shooting for the show, but Eric talks about, and I've got it in the companion, talking about how he feels like he should have had a half a writing credit on the show because half of what they did was putting those clips together and You know, of course, I think since then he's quit complaining about not having credit for Shades of Grey, but but that's why Shades of Grey exists, is because Hurley was out the door so fast that he's like, here, I'll do a clip show and I'll only have to write half a script and I'm out of here. Bye, guys. You know?
Yeah. So he leaves. It sounds like maybe not on the best of terms. It sounds like he kind of is fed up with Star Trek and won't discuss it. You know, I've heard that numerous times. And yet he still came back.
I think he was fine. I don't think he left. It wasn't like bad blood when he left. I think he just went, well, this is going nowhere fast. I'm kind of, it's not my thing.
Yeah.
You know, he was, and plus he was doing what Gene wanted. Gene was really wanting to do old style standalone episodes, not so much like not serialized, but you know, there was no reset button. Or, I mean, like it was more about the plot and the adventure than it was about the characters. And there was very tiny little character movement the first, and then when Michael came in, it was all about the family, you know, the family and the bonding, and there started to be long arcs with people. It's almost like anything that moved the characters forward as people was kind of like accidental, or it was like plot driven. Well, we need this to happen in this show. So, oh, okay, well, all of a sudden now, you know, some of that was developing the backgrounds. Like, you kind of gradually got a little bit of Worf's background. Oh, he was raised by human parents and, you know, has a Klingon stepbrother, full-blood brother. Well, not, we didn't know it then, but, you know, he has a half-human stepbrother out there, and he's raised by human parents because they were massacred by Romulans. And Data was found on this colony, which the backstory for Data in Data lore is totally different than the one that's in the writer's guide at first. But, I mean, that's okay. That's bound to happen. But it is. And then a lot of the characters, you know, Geordi never got much of a background for the last couple of, you know, it was, oh, Geordi and his women problem. And other than that, there wasn't much to Geordi for the first 3 or 4 years. And I still don't think Riker had anything consistent about him until they finally got the thing of why he turned down command 3 times. And that was Best of Both. I always thought Best of Both Worlds was as great a writer Riker show as it was anybody else.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, but I mean, you know, what I'm saying is the characters this didn't hit me till years later, really, thinking about it. But the characters, they're all plot-driven. They're plot-driven like the original series was. And Gene was, you know, that was kind of the way they were driving it. But as Gene stepped back more and more, and then especially when Michael came in, he was looking at the characters with some arcs. Even if the plots didn't have long arcs, the characters were starting to get arcs. And then by the time Jerry came in and was trying to build up Troy and Crusher and, you know, and some of the, and start, like, hey, we've barely done anything with Geordi here. What's the deal? You know? We're short on Riker and Geordi stories. Good grief. You know, cause like Data was just a natural magnet for stories. And of course Picard did. And who am I leaving out here? And the women and Worf was a natural magnet for stories. So, you know, that's just kind of the way it went. But I really think that he was just kind of his perception of the show, and I was talking about Hurley again. I think he was kind of at his, I don't want to say his wit's end, but I think he was kind of burned out. Like, you know, I don't know what, you know, I don't, how much longer can I keep coming up with like great science fiction ideas? We write plots around them. And, you know, he had other writers helping too, but I think that's kind of where he was. I think he was kind of burned with it. So,
yeah. So it really isn't that strange that, especially if he was friends with Piller, that he came back a couple times in later seasons to write some episodes. So, okay. Well,
turn about fair play.
Yeah.
He got him in the door and yeah.
So let's talk briefly about the last time that he wrote something for Star Trek, even though it never actually saw the light of day, and that's the secondary treatment for Star Trek VII, which would become Generations. There were two treatments commissioned for potential movies. One was the one that we saw, which was written by Ron Moore and Brandon Braga, and then the other one was a treatment written by Maurice Hurley. And I know that there's not a lot known on that, but we did dig up a little bit of info. I mean, I remember when this happened, and I guess what the criteria was, like, it had to have Shatner in it, right? It had to have Kirk somehow.
Yeah, the whole idea was it was going to be a baton handoff from the old generation to the new generation. I mean, you know, for not in Trek canon needs, but in audience cultural perceptual. Here's what Paramount thinks as a movie franchise we should be doing. Blah blah. You know.
So were they like freaking out? I mean, because you were there, you know, while all this was going on, right? I mean, was there sort of like a kind of like general freak out thing going on around the Star Trek offices at that time where they're like, we really can't mess this up. This is a big deal. Or was it just kind of like business as usual?
Well, there was a little bit of that. So by 94, the show, remember where they are. It's not the first couple of seasons we've been talking about. It's the seventh damn season of Next Gen, and they got the Emmy nomination for series, which was kind of unheard of. And, you know, Next Generation had spun off one series and was about to spin off another one. And the Trek franchise was riding high, and there was no franchise bigger in TV than Star Trek, and the sci-fi boom was on, and so there was some of that. There was a lot of clout. And yeah, there was that's cool for TV guys, but can you translate to big screen? And Rick was being very confident about how he carried on. And he pulled a lot of people, a lot of TV people, almost all of the staff and all their various jobs were coming along for the ride on the movie. He wanted to give everybody a movie chance, you know, give everybody a chance at an Oscar nomination instead of just an Emmy kind of a thing. And some, you know, Dennis McCarthy did the theme, did all the music, scored the show, and, you know, up and down the line. You know, Mike Westmore had an Oscar for Mask. So not just making one, but for the movie called Mask. Yeah. You know, a lot of people had worked in features, so it wasn't a big stretch. But there was a little bit. I think the bet hedging was in the fact that I think he probably deep down, they had just written the finale, but even before they wound up doing the finale, Ron D. Moore and Brandon Braga, I think he thought they were the hot, juicy, young, great writers who could do the script. He may have had to convince Paramount that it was worth trusting this, you know, multi-million-dollar franchise-shifting movie with these young guys, and maybe just as a back, whether for his own sanity or just as a safety valve for the studio, for the movie side, had. Let's commission two scripts. It's almost like NBC commissioning three scripts from Gene after The Cage, you know, and then they picked one. It's like, well, we like The Cage, but we had the problem, so let's do these three. And then Gene wrote one of them, you know, and they didn't pick Gene's script for the second pilot, you know, kind of a thing. So it's a little bit like that little game. It's like, let's do two options, and then we can pick the one we really wanted all along, or you can pick the one you like best, but I know which one it's really going to be. But we'll do the other one for show and all that. I mean, I really kind of think that's where some of that came from, and it may have been like reassuring. Instead of just saying, hi, I'm having these two 28-year-old guys do the next movie script, which isn't unheard of, especially these days. But it was, you know, the 90s were still a little saner, and and they weren't quite so used to having, you know, 20-somethings do these tentpole franchise movies. But anyway, I think that's what it was. And what's great is at the time I was doing the book, yeah, by this time I was involved and immersed and racing around on deadline. And I'd done the first edition, so this was the red book, but it was still an insane deadline trying to cram the movie into the two seasons we did, but also the movie. And the fact that, you know, and Rick was, you know, always kind of closed-mouthed about things. And even though I had the book and the contract and it was official and licensed, I never saw any documentation, even like a draft, like a memo or something on Hurley's version of the script. I hear people talk about it, and what we were talking about that other side of the room there early on. We can talk about it some more, but they, you know, the marching orders were, the whole point was to have Kirk and Picard interacting and to see the two, you know, the big captain baton handoff. And the generational handoff, even maybe the crew-to-crew in some way. And there was the goofy idea floating around. The studio wanted the two ships in a battle with each other, which was, you know, made no sense. It was stupid. And, and talked them off that. But, yeah, so Hurley's idea was Picard consulting Kirk on the galactic crisis with interphasic space. And it's basically getting back to the Tholians and having that be a crisis, but Kirk is a holodeck recreation. It's a Leah Brahms 2 kind of situation.
Yeah,
Yeah, that doesn't seem like it would work as well. I mean, I love Generations a lot more than most people. But, you know, even if I'm taking in, you know, some sort of like personal bias with that, it still seems like this idea may not have been the most solid choice in the world, you know? So, I don't know. Well, okay. Well, I mean, I guess that pretty much covers, you know, Hurley's career on Trek. Is there anything that we're missing? Anything that we should add, you know, before wrapping this up?
Well, I was going back through my notes here real quickly. He actually came to the staff when The Naked Now started to shoot.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's like, what, second episode, right?
Yeah.
Second or third episode?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty early on then. Yeah.
Exactly. Wow. And he'd been on Miami Vice as well as, The Equalizer? Yeah. He'd been at Universal.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pretty straight ahead action adventure, you know, drama, mystery, standard. Interesting. The Equalizer was always kind of like a crowd favorite that didn't have huge numbers, but it was, you know, those fan awards that came out in the 80s to save Cagney and Lacey, and then they, pre-internet way of the fans having some clout and power was, you know, start your own awards and reward what you like, regardless of politics or numbers. And so he, you know, he'd been involved with some really good kind of hard-edged but good character shows. So, you know, good on him.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us and telling us a little bit about what Hurley was doing. I would say we really appreciate it, but apparently I always say that and I just got called out on it. So I don't appreciate it at all.
By some of the listeners or
another guest, you know, but whatever. It is what it is.
Okay. Yeah, you know what? So I'll say it. I really appreciate you being on the show.
I like you. So yeah, it was so, Larry. It's okay. Come back or don't. We don't care.
So where can people find you these days, or what have you got coming up?
People can find me astounded that we had this much to talk about Maury Hurley. I was skeptical at first, I have to say, guys, but I guess we found a way to round it out, and without hopefully blabbing on, you know, at length too much. But, LarryNemechek.com is where people can always find me. This is an interesting year. Enterprise in Space is hopefully the nonprofit that I'm now the national spokesman for and doing outreach at conventions. Here in a couple months, may have a huge announcement about a funding commitment, and although we're still crowdfunding for this nonprofit flight to put 100-plus student experiments from around the world on an orbiter, which would be the first real spacecraft named Enterprise in Space. That's exciting. So I hope everybody goes to enterpriseinspace.org. But the rest of all the projects, you know, the next year's the 50th anniversary of Trek and Geek Nation tours. We're doing our LA to Vegas tour next year. And we're at with some major tweaks before the Vegas convention that week. And before that, a few days, we're adding on a San Francisco, bit bopping around San Francisco with you know, real landmarks and fictional landmarks that are all Trek related. So, you know, come over to Geek Nation Tours and look at the LA to Vegas site. And then closer to my Bailey Gricken in the here and now, working on my voiceover career, but Trekland on speaker volume 4 is going to be out at Vegas and then online immediately to order. And of course, you know, Fearless Leader Chris basically art directs and remasters, produces that with me, for me, and I appreciate that. So number 4 is going to be about the anniversary. It's going to be about Voyager's pilot caretaker.
I was just getting it lined up,
and hopefully have some more little obscure bits, aside from like Jerry Taylor talking and Rick Colby, the late, great Rick Colby, the director, talking about, you know, firsthand experiences and stories, and he's good. He's on one of the other CDs, talking about all good things. Hoping to have some things from, like, Alan Sims, the prop master, and some of the other, and Dan Curry, visual effects, some of the other bits and pieces about getting Voyager off the ground and launching, and, you know, some of the great things and some of the not-so-great Kazon. bits of the opening there. So that's coming up. And then I have the Trekland trunk, my artifacts getting out, if anybody wants to come over and look. And we do the live auctions on Sunday on Facebook. I say that they're like little 3-hour mini things, but if you go to Trekland Trunk on Facebook, it's basically a glorified list. So I don't feel too oily and smarmy like a used car guy. You just come there if you're interested, and if not, don't worry about it. But this summer, with all the big cons coming up, SoonerCon here, but Comic-Con San Diego, I have a panel Thursday night and two-part day signing, and then we're going to do a Dr. Trek show that's a fundraiser for the Con of Wrath. And we're trying to wrap up the Con of Wrath filming this year. We just did 5 people here in Dallas and Oklahoma City this week. And, we've got Nichelle in March, and I must say that after this year we've had of losing people in Trekland, that when I heard about Nichelle's stroke, my heart kind of leaped up. I guess I go, please, not another one, but thankfully not. But we did have her in the can from March. And we're just going to round out the year getting a few more people, hopefully get over to the East Coast and get a few people, some survivors from over that way. But we're trying to get that out for next year. That's about it. I have a whole new thing that I'm about. I'm sometime in the next month going to actually announce it. So I just hope everybody come over and get on my news list at Nimichek.com, LarryNimichek.com, and Trekland on Facebook, and at Larry Nimichek on Twitter, because in the next month I'm going to be announcing something that's a whole new thing in Trek fandom, never been done before, and it's a very personal bit that I can share more with fandom. And no, it's not a podcast per se, and it's not a cola, not a root beer, but but something totally different. And I'm still settling down even on the name of it, so you'll just have to stay tuned. So I've either teased the hell out of you, or I've totally put you to sleep by now. So
no,
I can't wait.
Or maybe both.
I know, anxiously awaiting to hear what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I don't appreciate it, but you are more than welcome back anytime. And I know that our listeners certainly appreciate it, because whenever you come on, all of a sudden people start listening to our show. So So yeah, anytime. Like, even if someone doesn't die, you're more than welcome to come on the show.
Yes, the door is always open.
Guys, come on. It's been a rough
year. I know,
year.
It's crazy. This has been the worst year ever for Star Trek by far. So, All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks much.
Well, that was fun having Larry on. It's always good to talk to him. He's got an insane amount of knowledge about Next Gen.
Yeah, he is. Wow. Talking to him is always fun.
And, he was telling us off mic on the other side of the track, or whatever you want to call it, that, he was in today, he was in at Oklahoma City, I guess, at SoonerCon, which is a convention down there. And that's where he's from and everything. So I guess he goes there every year. But he met a guy. He put a picture of him up on his Twitter feed. His name is Wofford, I guess. And this guy told him that he has the entire catalog of Trek FM shows archived on his computer.
That's flattering. And wow.
I mean, amazing. I want to know if he's listened to them all. Because, I haven't even listen to, I haven't even listened to all the shows that I've been on. Let's put it that way. So, yeah, thank you, Wofford.
Yeah, that's, it really is, though, if you think about it, really flattering that somebody digs the network that much.
Also, we'll know where to come when we lose all of our files.
Yeah, when Trek FM gets attacked by a Borg virus. We know where we can go to reclaim everything.
Yes. So thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, very much.
Well, it's been fun talking about Maurice Hurley today, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit. you know, watching it live to 3 months after the series ends to watch the Mirror Universe episodes.
You're like, whoa, man, I heard season three got dark, but this is crazy.
It got darkly.
Oh.
Earl Grey.
We divide the ship into one of two ways. Port goes to port. I better not see any starboard guys on the starboard phaser target practice. You guys know which side of the ship you're on.
The orb.
And so they cannot impart to him the knowledge that he needs in order to raise his son. And Worf doesn't want to raise a human son. Like you said earlier, he didn't get the son that he wanted. He wants to raise a Klingon son.
The ready room.
We knew that Spock was popular, and we knew that Dad had some fans, but we were not prepared for what we saw happening in the social media, in the print media. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the New York Times reported that they got more hits on Dad's obituary than any other personality in the history of the paper.
To the journey!
You're not a member of our race or a member of our culture, so we're going to say no.
That's kind of boring, and yet I don't know what else to do.
Oh, screw you!
Sorry, buddy.
Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school. I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go with Silic and the Sulaban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's all of these top-notch filmmakers, like people like Walter Murch, who literally wrote the book on editing. He, like, those guys all teaming up to make a big action kids movie, I think is really cool.
The 602 Club.
I think he's very much recreating that THX feel, and you may disagree with it. You may not think it's, you know, it's great, but it's on purpose. He wants that world to be that way.
Let me just say, conceptually, I agree with that. In terms of execution, that's where I think he failed.
Literary Treks.
It's amazing to me, as I reread these stories, how much of it I just kind of think of as Deep Space Nine these days, even though it wasn't part of Deep Space Nine, you know, the actual series.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters, that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
So she definitely knows cats. I say that right off the bat.
She knows cats and Bones.
Yes, definitely. Of course Bones would get annoyed with all the cat fur.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And beyond. Star Trek Beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search in iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3s directly from our website. Or grab the RSS link as well. Oh, I forgot to mention. I'm sorry. I have to bring this up. True Detective Season 2 started up. I know I've brought it up the past 2 weeks. Finally watched the first episode. It is amazing. I know there are people who are like, this is garbage. It's not nearly as good as Season 1. Yes, I'm sorry. It's not nearly as good as the best season in television history, but it's still awesome. And the thing that makes it super awesome, in addition to other things, is the direction. You want to know how cool this guy is? This Justin Lin dude who's making this new Star Trek movie right now? This show, which is on network television, in an aspect ratio of 16:9, just like your network television, he's shooting it in anamorphic widescreen and then cropping it just so that he can get that anamorphic look like all of the Star Trek movies aside from number 6 have.
Wow.
That's how cool and how good this dude is. He is on point. You know, if you look at this, the Fast and the Furious movies and his episodes of Community, you can see someone who can, I mean, his episodes of Community are really freaking good. He did the paintball episode from season 1, right?
Okay, yeah.
he can do anything. I am convinced. And I am convinced that this Star Trek Beyond is not going to be Fast and the Furious in space. It's going to be Star Trek the way it should be, because this guy knows how to do whatever's appropriate for the material. So I just wanted to just say that and say go watch True Detective Season 2 because it's the bomb.
Thank you for building us all up for Star Trek Beyond. Because yes. now I'm really excited. And if it's not fantastic, it's going to be you that I blame, Mike.
That's how it works. I'm more than willing to accept the blame, you know. Anyway, another way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar of the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at trekfm. Or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, where we also have the Babel Conference. Just type in the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, look for me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. And otherwise, you can find me on a weekly podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my friend Craig. And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew, or you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where I do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic. I've recorded 3 episodes in 2 days, and I'm recording another one tomorrow, and I'm going to get all caught up.
Good grief, man. You're a machine.
I just need to edit them. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
And then you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find all of us on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all our other shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for. John, what book do you have for us this week?
Well, this week, since we did talk quite a bit about Q, we have Q Squared by Peter David, narrated by the great John DeLancey. In all of his travels, Captain Picard has never encountered an opponent more powerful than Q, a being from another continuum that Picard encountered on his very first mission as captain of the Starship Enterprise. In the years since, Q has returned to harass Picard and his crew. Sometimes dangerous, sometimes merely obnoxious, Q has always been mysterious and seemingly all-powerful. But now, Trelane, another member of the Continuum who Captain Kirk and his crew first encountered over 100 years ago, has tapped into an awesome power source that makes him more powerful than the combined might of the entire Continuum.
Yeah, I've read this book. I read it when it came out. It's awesome. I really like it. Peter David is obviously awesome.
Yeah.
His comic books are cool. His novels are cool. And this book is really good. I highly recommend it. It's got some crazy, weird time travel stuff. He does like tracks, like track 1, track 2, track 3, because there's all these alternate timelines. And then it gets to the end and he's like, derailment. You know, I mean, it's
That's
like crazy.
Awesome.
Yeah. So definitely check it out, especially if you're nerdy and into like alternate realities and alternate timelines and simultaneously. It's very similar to All Good Things, actually, which is kind of crazy. But check it out. And you can get it for free since you listen to Trek FM. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. All right, well, that's it for Maurice Hurley's work on Star Trek. Next week, we're going to look at the first of 2 movies that he wrote, this one being The Proposal, which you can find on Netflix. So go over to Netflix, watch The Proposal, get all ready for next week. You can hear us talk about it.
Yeah. Take your notes. Be prepared.
Yes. Until then, keep on trekking. No. We really appreciate you listening. How about that?